on this epic trail. "Blimey, you look different," my pop says as he eyes my leathery skin and loose-fitting clothes. It's so good to see the old boy, and as we fall into step together, I start to tell him about some of the recent sections and the people and places I've come across since we last saw each other. The walk begins with a ferry crossing to East Portlemouth. The only other passenger is a fellow walker, also with his sheepdog in tow. We soon get chatting and discover his name is Barry, and he's walking a 7-day stretch of the path. As we chat, Tiny and Barry's dog do a stellar job of completely ignoring each other. Although, to be fair, Tiny is slightly preoccupied with the concept of boat travel at this juncture. After the crossing, we part ways with them and continue along the woodland path, putting the world to rights as we do so. We pass a few elaborate waterside mansions as the tree-laden path crosses tracks and roads in a bid to leave civilization behind. Once we leave the woodland, the trail picks up where it left off prior to Sulcombe, and the scenery is staggeringly beautiful. The area is owned by the National Trust, and as such does not disappoint. The thin, undulating track winds up and down rocky outcrops and through the dramatic, unspoilt landscape. The skies are filled with a thickening mist that adds further atmosphere to the scene as we hear the invisible waves crashing below us. Despite the mist, the air is still close, with a sticky heat and, not for the first time, it's difficult to believe we're on the Devonshire coast rather than some far-flung exotic location. Having recovered from the ferry crossing, Tiny is revelling in the trek as she runs off to explore her new surroundings and then periodically waits, impatiently, for us to catch up. We pass the wonderfully named Gammon Head and the secluded beauty of Ellender Cove before arriving at Prawl Point, where Pops has to turn back. We sit eating lunch, looking out to sea through the mist. We discuss some of the places I've still got ahead of me and how strange the idea of reaching the finishing line is. We say our goodbyes, and I watch him disappear through the mist with Tiny by his side. A little emotional, I chomp down the final mouthful of the day's Mars bar, apply the trusty stiff upper lip, and venture forth once more. The walking continues to be quintessential SWCP for the next few miles. Winding single-file hillside tracks strewn with jagged rocks above the crashing waves. The gulls, absent until now, appear above me, creating striking silhouettes amid the mist, backlit by the obscured sun behind. I consult Rowley to discover I'm well over halfway through the day's walk to the intriguingly named Bee Sands. Somewhere just before start point, I catch up with Barry and his dog, and we walk together for the remainder of the day. Start Point is an impressive open space with majestic views in all directions. After swapping some walking stories, including the obligatory Heartland to Bude experience comparison, we exchange abridged life stories over the course of the next couple of hours. Barry is about 5'11" and probably the thinnest man currently alive. He looks like I imagine I would look if I just kept walking this path for the next 20 years without stopping. He has spent most of his life in the RAF and is now semi-retired, having to work part-time in a supermarket to keep things comfortable. This seems a bit harsh for an ex-serviceman, all things considered, but then I've only just met the chap. Perhaps he's one of those peculiar people you hear about who enjoy working. To cut to the chase, Barry is a thoroughly good egg. A few miles on and we arrive at the lost village of South Hallsands. A long since abandoned collection of cottages that have been half swallowed by the sea. The semi-ruins of houses that once made up a thriving fishing community now edge ever closer to the merciless ocean. One by one they are claimed by the waves. The scene is made all the more gloriously spooky by the continued misty conditions. Barry explains that disaster originally struck when constructors working on a nearby dockyard basically pinched tons of shingle from underneath the ill-fated village. Although Rowley, not wishing to have his thunder stolen by the fancy-pants real-life human newcomer, quietly points out that this is, in fact, only rumour. The remaining descent into Bee Sands is an easy one, and once we arrive at the pub, I've booked a room above, I say my goodbyes to Barry. He's off to nearby Torcross, and I wish him all the very best for the rest of his trip. Besans is a strange place. No two ways about it. A row of houses, including the pub I'm staying at, that are separated from the sea by a single-track road and a small concrete wall. It's completely flat and straight. It should, by all rights, be an ugly place, but it isn't. It has a minimalist beauty to it that I'm struggling to convey. The pub is a decent gastro affair, and my room a comforting back-to-basics number when compared to the luxury of the previous night. I call Pops and tell him about the rest of the walk. I then call up Tasha, my mum, and speak to a few friends over WhatsApp. I order chips and a pint of ale and settle in for the evening. The first few miles of the walk the following day are a surreal continuation of the flat, straight line of Besans, through the village of Torcross and on to Slapton Lay. Torcross is Besans, but more so. Both villages and the subsequent section along Slapton Lay make for a very interesting change of terrain, unlike anything I've experienced thus far. That being said, after only a few miles, I'm glad they are an exception rather than a norm. I walk alongside the Arrow Strait, slightly elevated road, with a nature reserve on one side and the sea on the other. The mist and sticky heat of yesterday continue, and I'm accompanied by frequent rain showers. Hundreds of gulls sit watching me as they bob up and down on the water. The path does eventually rise up to the hilltops once I'm past Slapton, and get back to something approaching familiarity. I stride in and out of woodland sections and over sprawling farmland as the rain continues to intermittently fall. The mist eventually clears, just in time for the impressive Blackpool Sands to reveal itself through the tall, imposing trees that surround it. I emerge from the woodland to discover the yellow sands of this usually full-to-bursting picturesque beach nearly completely deserted. I decide there can be no better luncheon location and plonk myself down. I delve into the backpack to pull out the last spicy sausage treat. I need to stock up when I arrive in Dartmouth later today, and in light of Mickey B's raised eyebrow, I vow to select a more ethically acceptable lunchtime treat for the remainder of the trip. I devour the sinful sausage in seconds. I cannot lie. I've come to relish the forbidden faux salami over the last few weeks. But, as some complete numpty once said, in some soul-destroying business seminar I once attended, in what now seems like another lifetime, there are no traffic jams on the extra mile. I'm sorry, dear reader, it was utterly unacceptable of me to subject you to a motivational mantra of such awfulness. Consider it fully retracted. A short while later, the path diverts inland around Stoke Fleming. The rain returns with force, and I decide to seek shelter. I'm walking through a field next to a housing estate as the path heads back towards the sea. I duck into a shelter attached to some public toilets at the edge of the field, next to a small play park area. Within a couple of minutes, I'm joined by an older chap, complete with walking poles, cagoule and backpack. It transpires that he's walking the whole of the coast path in the opposite direction to myself. We get chatting, and in a thick accent that I soon find out originates from Middlesbrough, he advises me that this is the second time he's walked the whole 630 miles. It gets to you. You'll see. You'll try other walks, but this path never leaves you. You'll be back. The first time he walked it, he went the same way round as myself, and so I take the opportunity to ask what, on reflection, is a foolhardy question. Is the best of it behind me already? Oh, God, yes, no doubt about that. Duh. When the rain eventually eases up, I wish him all the best and get going once more. As I approach the mouth of the River Dart, I pass Dartmouth Castle, an impressive structure dating back to the 14th century. As the castle is now open to the public, the remaining path into Dartmouth itself is a well-maintained and easy-going wide track. It gently ambles through the wooded hillside overlooking the river as I slowly descend into the attractive harbour town. I've arranged to meet Sophie and Dan for a second time in Dartmouth and then stay the night at theirs. Sophie is going to walk tomorrow's stretch to Brixham with me, where we then due to meet Tasha and Paddy. Another pleasant evening ensues, as we spend a few hours in a local pub, before heading back to theirs. At one point, we are accosted by an eccentric American woman in the pub garden. She is dressed as though it's the bleak midwinter in Alaska, with a long trench coat, gloves, and some kind of elaborate woolly hat. She decides to sit down next to us uninvited and share in great detail her garbled philosophy on life, the universe and everything. I mention this because my lasting memory of the event is our three individual reactions to our unwelcome guest, which to my mind somehow capture our individual personalities perfectly. I shuffle uncomfortably and avoid eye contact, hoping that the whole embarrassing situation will just go away. Dan cheerily attempts to engage with the clearly heavily inebriated woman in the belief that every stranger is just a friend you haven't met yet, no matter how strange the stranger. Sophie tells her she's an idiot and should probably get lost. The entourage arrives. Agatha's house and powerboat racing on the English Riviera. Our walk begins across the water from Dartmouth in Kingswear the following morning. There is no sign of the mist from the last few days, and the sunlit views down the River Dart are exceptional. Rowley, in the long-winded way I've become accustomed to in this troublesome third incarnation, tells me that the 11-mile trek to Brixham is a tough one. The trickiest on the South Devon stretch, in fact. It begins leisurely enough, however, as we amble along above the riverside, heading back towards the sea. We enjoy the views of the castle standing majestically amongst the trees before the path leads us into dense, tropical green woodland, and then starts to climb. I've always found it easy to talk to Sophie, so it's a pleasure to have her company for the day's increasingly challenging walk. She expressed concern at joining me initially, as it's been a while since she's done any decent length hiking. I have noticed with a few friends, come to think of it, that having a baby does have a tendency to dramatically cut into your fun time. In any event, she needn't have worried, as we walk comfortably in step under the clear blue skies and warm sunshine. Having left the woodland behind, the path is throwing up some mean climbs and drops as it winds through the increasingly rocky landscape. We pass the twin points of Inner and Outer Frowland, with their Second World War defence posts and views out to Mew Stone. Apparently, Mew Stone, which is another way of saying Gull Rock, of which there are hundreds along the southwest coast path, is prime seal spotting country. There's a fair few people about on this stretch, which would seem to lend credence to this notion. Alas, however, not a single one of the blighters about today. An awful lot of gulls, though. I briefly entertain the idea that it's these brazen seabirds themselves that are spreading the rumour of seals around Mew Stone, with a view to enticing unsuspecting picnickers into their lair. If so, it certainly seems to be working, as I watch them feigning an uninterested nonchalance, whilst creeping up on the numerous families munching on their sandwiches, blissfully unaware of the encroaching winged assassins. The walking continues to be tough going in the run-up to Scabbercombe Head. As the day wears on and we start to think about lunch, I take the opportunity to impart some hard-earned wisdom to my less experienced companion. "The trick is, Soph," I say, adopting an authoritative tone, "to always stop for lunch at the top of a hill, never at the bottom of one." She's looking impressed by this point. "That way, after you've rested and eaten, you don't have a climb on a full stomach." As we continue along the winding rocky path, I'm sensing that Sophie, probably like Mickey B before her, is pretty overwhelmed by my zen-like relationship to my surroundings. I'm probably something akin to a spiritual guide to them. About 15 minutes or so later, my blood sugar levels drop and, feeling a bit faint, I insist we stop for lunch immediately, at the bottom of a very steep hill. "But I thought you were just saying..." "Look, Soph, it doesn't matter who said what. You really need to adopt a less structured approach if you're to survive life out here on the trail." After wolfing down our homemade sandwiches, we get going once more towards Scabbercombe Sands and then on to the superbly named Man Sands. Eventually we arrive, earlier than anticipated, at the National Trust Cafe on Berry Head. The views out to the glimmering sea are fantastic, and have been for most of the day. The sun is still beating down as we rest up with a couple of well-earned ice creams. There only remains an easy descent of a few miles down into Brixham Harbour to meet Tasha and Paddy. Tasha calls me to let me know they've arrived, and so, Mr. Whippy's duly dispensed with, we get moving again. Brixham is a very attractive and bustling fishing town, with a thriving tourist industry. It's built around the busy harbour, adorned with cafes, bars and restaurants. Tasha and Paddy are sat outside at one such caff, drinking tea and looking out over the water. We all greet each other enthusiastically and sit together for an hour or so in the sunny, picturesque spot. Soph leads off home, but will return later with Dan and Ezra to join us for dinner. Tasha, myself and Paddy are all staying in the same hotel, and Paddy dutifully retires to his room to allow us a couple of hours alone before we meet the others again. Tasha tells me about the local council elections, where she did a sterling job, increasing the Greens' share of the vote in her ward significantly. She also manages to assure me that Bovril is alive and definitely pining for me. His facial muscles are incapable of showing expression of any kind, of course, but Tasha reassures me that she can clearly tell that he absolutely misses me. Like the deserts miss the rain, no doubt about it. It's great to hear that all is well with the homestead. I regale her with some of the highlights of the walk so far, and we generally bask in each other's company for a while before meeting up with Paddy again. Paddy, by way of introduction, is our next-door neighbour in Bristol. A dapper chap in his mid-80s who always looked out for us and been only too happy to provide us with hot meals and plenty of booze over the years. He's a bit of a legend, and it's really something that he's come all this way to see us. Although knowing Paddy, he probably considered it his duty to accompany Tasha on the trip to ensure a lady does not travel alone. We meet up with Soph, Dan and Ezra and decide on one of the many fish and chip restaurants along the harbour side. We all enjoy the freshly caught delights on offer, and a great evening is had by all. Outside the restaurant, we pose for a group photo, and I realise, with a wry smile, that the entourage has finally arrived. If only the big 630 man from Zenna could see me now. What's more, we're meeting Mickey B and Hayley in the morning. But for now, I say my goodbyes to Soph, Dan and Ezra, for what will probably be the last time of the trip. I thank them for their kind hospitality. They wish me luck for the rest of the walk, and we all promise to catch up again as soon as possible. Paddy then retires to bed, and Tasha and I spend the remainder of the evening in a nearby pub, chatting with the odd local and watching the world go by. We meet Mickey B and Hayley from the coach after breakfast the next morning, on what is already another glorious day. As Mickey B notwithstanding, there is a general lack of enthusiasm regards joining me for a day's walking, and taking into account that one of our party no longer has either of their original hips, I have planned a day out for us all. We're off to the National Trust-owned Greenway property, which was the summer residence of Agatha Christie, and is now something of a shrine to her. I'm a big Christie fan, and my excitement at the day ahead is just enough to eclipse the fact that no other member of our jolly troupe has ever read anything by the esteemed Queen of Crime, or has any real interest in seeing where she summered. Fools. Despite the lack of Agatha appreciation, the party is in tip-top spirits, and the day out is a roaring success in the summer sunshine. The house itself is a large Georgian number set in acres of immaculate gardens. We wander round and listen to the engaging staff as they enthusiastically deliver a potted history of the residence and its relationship to the great lady herself. We also take a walk down through the gardens to the famous boathouse perched on the edge of the River Dart, believed to be the actual boathouse from the classic novel Dead Man's Folly. We then take a well-earned rest at the on-site cafe, where we gorge on cake and banana milkshakes. Or at least I do. I haven't really noticed what anyone else is gorging on. That's their business. Later that afternoon, back in Brixham, and it's time to say goodbye to Tasha and Paddy already. They've booked seats on a coach for the long trip back to Bristol, and so we bid them adieu. I thank Paddy for making the effort to come all this way, and he wishes me luck for the rest of the trip. Tasha and I say our farewells for the second time in 6 weeks, and as I kiss her goodbye and watch the coach pull away, I feel a strong pang of homesickness for the first time. Mickey B and Haley are sticking around for an evening meal, and so the three of us head off in search of a restaurant along the harbour. After dragging them both to a nearby laundrette to give the old personals an overdue new leash of the good stuff, we settle for a large and bustling gastropub overlooking the water for dinner. I bring Mickey B up to speed with how things have been going since I last saw him, and the ale and lime cordials are soon flowing freely. I also discuss with Haley what action she intends to take regards Mickey B's unforgivable behaviour, re the whole missing half a mile just outside Plymouth debacle. She advises me that this is the kind of thing she has to put up with every day of her life. I sympathise with her. I mean to say, dear reader, you meet someone, fall in love in good faith, and then bang, 20 years later you realise you've ended up with a teetotal vegetarian from Barnsley who is hell-bent on sabotaging his friend's best-laid plans through substandard map reading. As afternoon becomes evening, I'm saying yet more goodbyes as Mickey B and Haley catch the bus out of town. After watching them go, I wander back towards my hotel for the night and look over the pretty harbour in the fading light. I'm conscious that I'll now be alone for the remainder of this ever-evolving adventure. It feels like I've been walking forever, and yet at the same time, like it's only just started and can't possibly be drawing to a close already. I focus on the immediate future and am comforted at the thought of adventures still yet to come. This incredible trail is not done with me just yet, and I am certainly not done with it. I awake with a start, and in a cold sweat the following morning, having had a terrible nightmare. I dreamt I was walking on the path next to the sea when I came across a large group of trendy hipster types drinking it. The sea, that is. They were dipping large mugs and glasses into the ocean and then swigging it back. I could actually see the sea level dropping as they were doing this. "Hey, what do you think you're doing?" I cry. "We're drinking the sea," came the reply from one of their beardy number. "But it's salted water," I counter, quite reasonably, I fancy. "Of course, it's all the rage," one says with a growing disdain at my ignorance, as those around him snigger and raise their eyebrows threateningly at me. "We've had salted caramel and sea salt chocolate. Now salted water is where it's at." I stare incredulously as they continue to drain the ocean. "Stop it!" I scream. "You're killing it! You're killing the sea, you stupid, stupid hipsters!" They all look at me, unfazed by my outburst. "Get a load of the square," one says. "Hey, square, why don't you buzz off, you square?" Then I look down and notice that I'm sweating banana milkshake from every pore. I run. Well, what would you have done? The short 9-mile walk to Torquay begins with a decent stroll through the woods. It feels great to be back on the trail again, and I have to check my excitement as, at my current speed, I'll arrive in Torquay before lunch. It's another clear and sunny day, and I'm even braving the shorts. My head and arms, as previously mentioned, are tanned brown to a leathery degree. The old legs, on the other hand, having hardly seen the light of day, are by contrast a brilliant white. The overall effect is that I'm wearing somebody else's legs. As I emerge from the woods, I begin to pass picturesque beaches, including the pretty and secluded Elbury Cove. Here I decide a paddle is in order, and spend a satisfying 20 minutes or so splashing around contentedly like an elderly Labrador might do. After one or two reasonable climbs, I walk alongside a railway line for a brief stretch in the approach to Paignton. Following a small inland diversion, I pass under an impressive viaduct before reaching Goodrington Sands. The long rows of beach huts here, with their immaculately painted front doors in every imaginable colour, evoke a somehow nostalgic reaction in me, as though they are transporting me back to childhood, but not my own. Conjuring up so many quintessentially British seaside images from postcards and paintings of times gone by, the circling and swooping gulls overhead completing the picture. The walking is now flat and easy, and if I'm honest, a touch uninspiring. More beach huts follow, not long after, at Corbin Beach. They are soon accompanied by more latter 20th century human detritus in the form of arcades and water slides. I feel as though I'm taking a tour of the British seaside through the ages, passing from the quaint beach huts and stripy-decked chairs of times gone by into the now slightly dilapidated neon arcades and hot-dog stands of my own youth. Dilapidated they may be, but the enticing beach-front establishments are enjoying a roaring trade in today's clement conditions. As I approach Torquay and the panoramic views of the city emerge through the haze in front of me, I'm struck initially by how attractive it all looks. I've never been to Torquay, and, based largely on Forty Towers, as well as hearing various derogatory japes at its expense regarding its moniker as the English Riviera, I was expecting a bit of a dump. I'm a big fan of us Brits' tendency towards self-deprecation, but I do think we sometimes do down our green and pleasant land unjustly. The view in front of me now, for example, would rival many a plush European coastal city. Stylish architecture, swanky hotels, and a bustling, attractive harbourside glimmer and sparkle in the bright sunshine. All sat atop cliffs of a deep red colour, rising from the calm blue sea below. After a pleasant wander around the pier, I find a spot to sit and eat lunch. Crowds are gathering nearby, and the reason why soon becomes apparent. The roar of engines can be heard out to sea, and a loud voice booms suddenly from a loudspeaker situated above my head. A fact I was unaware of until this exact moment. Apparently, there is an afternoon of powerboat racing in store. Fair enough. I sit and watch for the next hour or so as the vessels zoom around at breakneck speeds and jostle for position to the whoops and cheers of the crowds. It's all good fun, and I'm in good spirits as I wander off towards my hotel for the evening. A slightly run-down, out-of-town establishment with pink fluffy carpets and avocado bathroom furniture. Perfectly pleasant, however, and I spend a relaxing evening pottering around and writing up some notes. Post-breakfasting on the much-aforementioned wheat biscuit delights the following morning, it seems to be taking me an age to leave Torquay behind. I'm still in a distinctively residential area as I pass a striking, solitary offshore rock known as Hope's Nose. Once I do finally leave the urban sprawl, however, the path becomes surprisingly attractive in the run-up to Babbicombe. In particular, the dramatically jagged Anstey's Cove with its prominent and sharply pointed rock formations jutting out to sea. Despite the rawness of the landscape, I'm still very much in an inhabited area. The path itself is flat and manicured, and the odd passing yacht or fancy-pants sailboat lets me know I'm still in range of Torquay. Fortunately, once I pass the beaches of Babbicombe, the views stretching out ahead of me are wild and staggeringly beautiful. Luscious tropical green treetops adorn the rich red sandstone cliffs for miles ahead. The deep blue sea turns blood red as it mixes with the soil by the shoreline. The path itself climbs and falls steeply, and I'm revelling in the challenge of it as I pass repeatedly between deep dark woodlands and open rolling green farmland. Herds of dozing cattle relax in the dry heat as I stride past purposefully. As scores of vocal gulls and crows squabble in the skies above me, I'm back where I should be, where I need to be. A solitary moving dot on a vast, ancient landscape. The path, the sea, and me, forever onwards. As I pass through Maidencombe, I consult Rowley, who advises me that this area is home to a rare species of bird called the Searle Bunting. Chubby little critters, the size of a sparrow with yellow and brown markings. They've been reintroduced to the area by the RSPB, and thanks to their efforts, can now be seen relatively frequently. I spy a few along the next mile or so, and realise that I've seen them before at various points over the last few days. I think of all the different species of hedgerow birds I've encountered along this journey. Mile after mile, they've provided so much of the soundtrack to the walk so far. I'm annoyed with myself for making no effort whatsoever to learn the names of the many varieties I've seen, and vow to put this right for the future. The decent walking continues as I pass Labrador Bay and beyond. Having said that, some of the woodland sections stretch on for long enough that I find myself missing the sea for increasing periods of time throughout the day. The sound of the waves remains audible through the dark, dense bushes and trees, but miles seem to go by without even a glimpse. This does eventually change, however, and with a reassuringly tree-free view in front of me, I stop for a late lunch. I have a confession to make, dear reader. I've been avoiding telling you these last few days. I've purchased more processed spicy sausage snacks. Listen, I have a problem, OK? I need sympathy and support, not judgment. I went into the shop in Brixham with the very best of intentions. Honestly, I did. But what can I do? Cheese is out. We've learnt that. I'm smelly and sweaty enough as it is, without reintroducing more smelliness and, sweatiness. Sandwiches of any description aren't going to last days on end in my backpack, so, you see, my hands are tied. I'm not proud, even though they do taste ruddy yummy. I'll become a vegan when I finish the walk or something, or only eat roadkill, maybe. Anyway, I scoff down the forbidden meaty snack and move on to the trusty Mars bar. When this book becomes an international bestseller, the good people of the Mars Corporation will probably send me a free lifetime supply of Mars bars on account of the free positive advertising. I should make it clear, therefore, that I will also accept Mars ice creams or Mars milkshakes, but don't try and fob me off with Snickers. I'm not Mr. T. The afternoon jaunt toward my final destination of Teignmouth is highly enjoyable in the summery conditions. The path leads me through further open farmland with decent ups and downs and a continued backdrop of far-reaching views in each direction. Eventually I arrive at the mouth of the River Teign, where I must catch the foot ferry to the other side. An impromptu meet-up with an old friend awaits me in Teignmouth. I was convinced I'd seen the last of the visitors on this trip, and so it's come as a pleasant surprise. Lou is a lovely lady I used to work with and who lives in nearby Newton Abbot. She's very kindly arranged to pop over and treat me to a pint in Teignmouth. I meet her on the promenade and we head into town and to the nearest pub. She brings her huge, gangly and lovable dog, Bodie, along. I remember countless teleconferences through work where the sound of Bodie barking in the background put many a speaker off their stride. So it's a pleasure to be able to put a face to the bark at last. We sit out in the afternoon sun, supping beer and eating chips. I retell some by now tried and tested anecdotes from the trip so far, and we generally gossip like a pair of old codgers. After a couple of hours, we say our goodbyes, and I head off towards my hotel for the night. I've been using an app on my phone to book the pubs, hotels, B&Bs and campsites that I've frequented throughout the journey so far. Usually, picking the cheapest one and booking it up the night before, or morning of, my expected arrival. Generally, this has gone pretty smoothly, with no real surprises. Tonight, however, I have inadvertently booked into a hotel for the visually impaired. I know this to be the case, even before I enter the building, due, for the most part, to the large signs clearly stating that this is a hotel for the visually impaired. I'm slightly nervous as I approach the main entrance, as I'm not sure if it's a hotel exclusively for the visually impaired. The lady at reception does look at me a touch suspiciously, but, to be fair, this could be for any number of reasons, and ultimately the transaction unfolds with no issues. For fairly obvious reasons, I've never been inside a building built especially for the visually impaired before, and I'm amazed by the ingenuity of the place. All the floors are sloped at certain angles, and the corridors are of varying widths to allow the clientele to navigate their way around freely. I keep nearly tripping over as I try to acclimatise to this. Later that evening, I wander back to the pub and spend some time working on my album of walking-themed classics, concerned that I may have been neglecting it of late. I come up with, "Do you know the way to Booby's Bay?" You know, as in, "Do you know the way to San Jose?" I practically write the whole thing. "Do you know the way to Booby's Bay? I've got to find some peace of mind in Booby's Bay. Plymouth is a great big feeling. It can leave you far away from home. With a dream in your heart, you're never alone. But dreams turn into dust and fly away, and there you are, without a prayer, your walking tracks and lugging packs." I assume I don't need to waste any time conveying to you how pleased I am with this masterpiece. The Red Seas, the Mighty Jungle, and something to do with Jane Austen. I begin the next day by popping a giant blister on my big toe and then eating four Weetabix. I'm a man of extremes. For today's walk, I've elected to stroll a meagre 7.5 miles and stop over in nearby Exmouth. This recent bout of short walks is fooling nobody, I realise, least of all myself. It's doubtless clear to one and all that I'm attempting to drag out the remainder of the trail and savour every last step between here and Poole. As I leave the hotel, the skies are filled with thick, dark clouds and a stiff wind ensures a noticeably colder temperature than of late. The gulls are out in force this morning, and I watch them squabbling, washing themselves amongst the waves and gliding gracefully overhead as I take the easy walk along the promenade out of Teignmouth. Even though the walking remains flat all the way to Holcombe, I'm enjoying being so close to the sea after seeing so little of it for long periods through the dense woodlands yesterday. The distant horizon, where the endless blanket of silky water meets the sky, is as mesmerising and mysterious to me now as it was leaving Minehead on day one. A few small ascents and descents through Holcombe fail to provide any physical challenge, but do reveal further impressive examples of the distinctive red cliffs that have characterised the coastline since Torquay. Somewhere around Dawlish, the path begins to run adjacent to a railway line. As with a previous stretch close to Penzance, the path is all that separates the sea on one side from the train track on the other. The effect is even more startling on this occasion, however, as both the railway line and sea are that much closer to the thin concrete walkway. The path is only accessible at low tide, and it's pure luck that I'm able to experience it as, and this may shock you, dear reader, I've not learnt my lesson rechecking the tide times. Wading through water armpit deep and costly enforced taxi rides are, apparently, not severe enough inconveniences to stir me into the complex action of taking 2 full minutes to check my phone each evening. Some tedious inland walking ensues thereafter, as I'm diverted away from the coast. This includes passing through a seemingly endless caravan and holiday park complex that brings with it the sudden emergence of crowds of people dressed for the beach. The rain has thus far held off, but the clouds still loom overhead, and the wind still brings with it a distinct chill. It's a scene that makes you proud to be British, as scores of determined holidaymakers stream past in shorts and flip-flops, whilst their shivering children desperately clasp buckets and spades with a steely resolve. As the path winds its way back towards the sea, I pass through residential areas in need of some regeneration, and am pleased when Starcross Railway Station finally appears ahead. Rowley advises me that the ferry crossing to Exmouth departs from somewhere next to the tiny open-air station, and so I wander through in search of the pick-up point. I have an hour to wait before the first ferry, and it's not even lunchtime. I make a decision there and then that there'll be no more short walks to prolong reaching the finish line. It's a false economy, as I'm only getting half a day's walking in, and there's too much hanging around involved. On the plus side, the wait at the ferry port yields another song idea. As I sit staring out across the River X, inspiration strikes, and I come up with, "Let's talk about X, baby." You know, like the salt and pepper classic. I know, brilliant, right? When the larger-than-I'm-used-to passenger ferry arrives, I'm still the only one waiting. I climb on board, take a seat, and sling my backpack onto the floor in front of me, humming, "Let's talk about X," all the while, just before the boat is due to depart, a couple climb on board and sit in the seats next to mine. A giant of a man with hands the size of gammon steaks and a smiley-faced blonde woman with matching blue puffer jackets. "Good Lord, what happened to you, lad?" says the giant, looking directly at me. "What do you mean?" I reply, suddenly feeling self-conscious. He turns to look at his partner. "Have we got any change to give this young lad, pet? He's down on his luck." There's a brief silence, during which my brain tries in vain to process a mountain of conflicting emotions, including embarrassment, hurt, shock and confusion. But then he bursts out laughing, as his partner rolls her eyes in mock exasperation. "I'm only messing with you, lad." He gives me a playful punch on the shoulder, which actually really hurts. "You must be walking the coast path." I regain my composure. Yes, that's right. The three of us chat through the rest of the journey, and I find it impossible not to warm to their infectious personalities. "Where did you start?" the woman asks. "Minehead. Can't believe it's nearly over already." They bolster my ego with some words of congratulations. "You know, I've always thought I'd like to walk that walk one day," says the friendly giant. His partner laughs and affectionately pats his pot belly. "That'll be the day, pet. That'll be the day." "I reckon I was a stone and a half heavier when I started," I chip in. "Really?" she replies, turning back to her partner enthusiastically. "Well, maybe you should walk it twice then, lover." After arriving in Exmouth and saying my goodbyes to my sailing companions, I find my hotel and check in for the evening. Past its prime doesn't really cover this one, dear reader. My room is a postage stamp that clearly hasn't had another human in it since the mid-70s. The door only opens a crack because the bed fills the entire room. The ensuite is a small wardrobe in the corner, and I have to climb on the toilet to close the door, so I can then access the shower. The decor is a fetching faded violet and mauve ensemble, and there's an unidentified layer of stickiness covering everything from floor to ceiling. Still, all good fun. It's dirt cheap, and by the seaside after all. By the time I sit down to breakfast the following morning, my chipper acceptance of my jaded lodgings is in danger of wearing thin. I'm sitting at a small, sticky table on a wobbly, sticky chair in a cold, dark dining room. I'm watching as rows of ants appear from my salt and pepper dispensers and attempt to make the arduous journey across the tabletop. It's too sticky for most of them, and they're left stranded in the invisible goo, in danger of losing limbs. A few of the hardier souls reach the safety of my cutlery and set up camp, surveying the carnage of the battlefield behind them. I'm moved to try and help some of the little blighters on their way, but I'm not all that keen on touching anything else inside the hotel from this point on, with the exception of the front door handle, and this is only through absolute necessity. Exmouth, like so many of the fading seaside towns along the south coast, gives the distinct impression that it fully expects it to be raining when you arrive. That being said, as I stroll along the esplanade towards the enticing cliffs in the far distance, I must concede that it makes a better fist of it than most. Away from the main strip, the attractive stone wall that separates the sea from the path is adorned with Victorian street lamps, and the yellow sands that run down to the sea do at least tip their hat to the notion of a sunny day. The weather this morning, however, is a continuation of the dark, moody skies and blustery winds of the previous day. After a mile or so, I reach the end of the esplanade and arrive at an area called Orcombe Red Rocks. A sign proudly proclaims that this is the oldest section of the Jurassic Coast, World Heritage Site. I climb the zigzag path to the clifftop, where a grassy track leads to the Geoneedle at Orcombe Point. An impressive structure built using stone and rock found on the Jurassic Coast. The views really open up here as well, and the scene in front of me has a distinct Jurassic feel to it. Vast red cliffs, sporadically adorned with rich, dark green flora, sloping down into the frothing red seas below. I half expect to see a pterodactyl glide by. The views in the other direction, back to Exmouth and beyond, are almost as equally striking, and I have a mounting optimism about the day ahead. Rowley seems a bit lukewarm in this regard, however, although I haven't got to know him in his latest guise as yet. That's right, dear reader, the troublesome Rowley Three has shuffled off this mortal coil. A sticky violet and mauve box room in Exmouth is his final resting place. Rowley Four has arrived, the final Rowley, the last guidebook to see me home. After a short but exhilarating stretch of clifftop walking with continued views in either direction, Rowley's tepid attitude towards the walk ahead is fully justified. The double whammy of an army rifle range on one side and a gigantic caravan park on the other comes into view. I begrudgingly navigate my way through the seemingly never-ending rows of mobile homes, distinguishable only by the signs above the doors. Names like the Cedars, the Bordeaux, the Windrush, anything as long as it's prefixed with the. It seems to take an age to reach the other side, but when I do, the sight in front of me is a pleasing one. I can see the village of Budley Salterton, where I intend to stop for lunch, in the distance. Between me and it stands what looks like a decent stretch of challenging cliff-edge walking. This turns out to be half true. The next mile or so involves a decent climb and some more beautiful scenery. The descent towards Budley, on the other hand, yields a golf course, some manicured pathways and a sudden downpouring of rain. When I do arrive in the village, though, the sun is shining and I quickly dry off as I stroll along the seafront. It strikes me that if I'd have walked a proper distance yesterday, I could have stayed in Budley Salterton rather than Exmouth. It's an attractive spot, with rows of colourfully painted fishing boats and old-fashioned beach huts lined up along the picturesque pebbly beach. I pass a sign that proclaims it an unspoilt village set amongst an area of outstanding natural beauty. I think about the notion of an unspoilt village, and what that description is actually telling me. Look, everyone, we found a bit that we as a species haven't completely ruined yet. Quick, everyone, gather here. I think of all the spoilt locations I've passed through in the last few weeks. The beachfront path eventually gives way to the promisingly named Otter Estuary Nature Reserve. I don't see any otters, unfortunately, but the inland stretch through the reserve and out to the cliffs on the other side is a pleasant enough one. A flat path navigating around the River Otter through attractive tall trees, salt marshes and a variety of contented bird life. Once I'm on the other side, I find a bench and stop for lunch. Mid-chomp, I hear a strange noise that sounds a bit like a cat's meow. I turn to see a gull staring up at me. It meows again. I wonder if the strange and distinctly un-gull-like noise signifies that it's injured in some way. I offer it some food, which it hoovers up immediately before turning to face me again and emitting the meow once more. It takes the sacrifice of a few more bites of my lunch before I realise what's really happening here. Blessed with this unique defect of birth, the bird has masterfully turned it round to his advantage. As I note how rotund the creature is, it's suddenly all too clear that I've fallen for a well-rehearsed act. Cunning little blighter. The afternoon's walk returns to the cliff tops as the weather continues to improve. A patchwork of rolling farmland stretches off to my left, but I'm spending most of my time looking out across the sea. It's staggeringly beautiful along this section. A seductive, silky, pearly blanket of water that emits a heavenly glow from underneath the dramatic, low cover of vibrant clouds. The cliffs bleeding their red soil into the sea from directly beneath me complete the otherworldly feel of my surroundings. The views in front of me spread out into the distance, and I get my first sight of the path beyond the red cliffs. Vast stretches of iconic chalk white coastline tantalisingly begin to emerge up ahead. I pass through Ladrum Bay and another holiday park. This is a smaller affair, though, and I barely notice it as I continue to gaze out across the water. Huge, detached clumps of sandstone cliff protrude from the lapping waves offshore, circled by skilfully swooping seabirds. I continue to stare, open-mouthed in awe, privileged to be witnessing the daily dramas of a 250-million-year-old landscape play out before me. I enter a stretch of woodland that will lead me down into my final destination for the day, the upmarket seaside resort of Sidmouth. After checking into my hotel, a vast improvement on the previous nights, I head straight back out to continue gazing at the pearly ocean. I spend the evening like this, finding a pub on the seafront with outdoor seating facing out to sea. I call the loved ones and relay back to them the day's trek. A mixed bag of a walk. Some truly spectacular, if all too short, stretches, interrupted by flat, uninspiring and inhabited sections. As ever with this trail, though, the stunning views bring with them the promise of the future, the eternal tomorrow. Early the following morning, I'm climbing up through a beautiful stretch of woodland covered in a blanket of bluebells. The delicate prettiness of the scene is in direct contrast to the severity of the climb. The pack is weighing heavy, but I'm grinning through the sweat as I reach the cliff top and am met by the first views of the day. Rowley has forewarned me regards the severity of today's hike to the fantastically and thirst-quenchingly named Village of Beer. I realise that I'm not just prepared for the tough trek, but am revelling in the prospect of it. It's difficult to pinpoint exactly when this change of attitude took place. Perhaps it's been a gradual realisation. Whatever the truth, at some point over the last 530 miles, I went from fearing the tough climbs to craving them. Over the next few miles, the path sets about testing this newfound cavalier attitude by throwing everything it has at me. Gloriously vicious ascents and drops follow each other in quick succession as I pass Salcombe Mouth and head towards Western Mouth. This section is hands down the best stretch of walking I've experienced in what suddenly feels like ages. Up until now, if I was to compose a list of top 10 walks of the trail so far, there would be a strong chance that they'd all be from the north coast prior to Land's End. Every step I'm taking currently is further confirmation that this is no longer the case. The path winds itself aggressively along the edge of the dramatic landscape. I pass the stunning Lime Cove, where it looks as though the sea has reached out and torn great chunks of the land away. The climbs continue to come thick and fast. At the peak of a particularly tough ascent, I pause to catch my breath. I survey the vast landscape below me. Through a clump of trees, I see a group of deer running free. A buzzard, the first I've seen in again what suddenly seems like an age, appears and hovers majestically. The bird is at my head height across the other side of the cove as I watch it circle, completely immersed. I feel momentarily overcome by a wave of emotion at what I'm looking at. This feeling of wilderness is one that's been sorely missing in recent days. I continue on my way, passing more wildlife as a group of horses cross the path ahead of me, emerging from over the hillside. I stop for lunch in Branscombe, before passing through more picturesque woodlands. A few miles later, I reach the first of the white cliffs that have been part of the view for the last day or so. As I approach Beer Head, the scene is as wondrous as the path is challenging. The rich red giving way to the chalky white as the ups and downs continue. I reach a beautiful area called the Hooken Cliffs. This brings me to a stretch named Underhooken that takes me beneath the huge imposing cliffs and along an undulating track, passing through the undergrowth. To see the cliffs from this new vantage point, looking up at their imposing stature, is simply fantastic. The section ends with a steep climb back up to the cliff top. From there, I begin the long descent into Beer. The village has an instantly more welcoming feel to it than anywhere I've been in the last few days. A pretty cove that feels wonderfully sleepy despite the crowded beer garden and deck chair-strewn beachfront. I pass a plot of allotments on the way in and can't think of a better spot to grow your marrows. The shimmering sea gently laps at the sand in the afternoon sunshine as I make my way toward my bed for the night. The Dolphin Inn turns out to be one of my favourite pubs and hotels along the whole coast path. A friendly welcome, affordable and comfortable rooms, and a decent laid-back bar and restaurant. Later that evening, I dine on scallops and potatoes, not chips, chat to the bar staff for a while, and write up a few notes. I then head back out towards the sea to join the crowds in the beer garden that overlooks the beachfront. As I sit, I look across at the path that leads steeply up the side of the cliff and out of the village for the start of tomorrow's walk. Here I remain, sipping contentedly as evening slowly changes to night and the velvety ocean fades into darkness. The perfect end to a perfect day. The walk to Lyme Regis the following morning, after a steep climb, begins with a trek into the village of Seaton. Rowley gets very excited as I pass over Axmouth Bridge and is keen to convey to me its historical importance. I'm afraid I'm only half listening, though, as I'm too busy hoping that the uninspiring pavement walking soon turns into something akin to the wilderness of yesterday. Things aren't looking promising, as I'm met with the unwelcome sight of yet another golf course around Axe Cliff. A short spell along an overgrown country track follows thereafter. The sun is out and in full swing now, and I'm getting a definite summer stroll vibe as flowers adorn the hedgerows on either side of the track. Then I come across a sign. I've reached the start of Undercliff National Nature Reserve, and the sign is a warning of what lies ahead. A 6-mile stretch deep in the dense wild woodland with no alternate escape routes until you reach the other side. Rowley had advised this was coming, but in the excitement of yesterday I'd forgotten all about it. It's a stretch I've been looking forward to, and my spirits soar as I take the thin path leading down into the rich vegetation. The path is slippery with mud as it winds downwards, and the sky disappears above me. I'm struck by an almost instant humidity in the air as I go deeper. The whole thing feels like I've just wandered into the jungle. I mean, I've never actually been to the jungle, but you get the general gist of things, I'm sure. What follows does not disappoint. The path winds through its thick, lush green surroundings as the terrain becomes gradually tougher. At times, I'm climbing over fallen trees and splashing through muddy bogs. I see occasional glimpses of the sea on one side and huge white cliffs on the other. The humidity continues to intensify, and I'm sweating buckets as I clamber through the bushes. The wildlife is out in abundance too, and I'm constantly batting away all manner of creepy crawlies as a chorus of birdsong rings out. At one point, I see a pair of shiny eyes staring at me through the vegetation. A fox, watching me pass by, turns and runs when I make eye contact. Over the next few miles, I see dragonflies, butterflies, many different species of bird, and even a deer or two. Around each corner is something new and unexpected as the path continues to navigate its way through the undergrowth. The views around Whitlands Cliff in particular are immense, and a reminder that what you are walking through is, in effect, a vast landslip. When I do eventually emerge from the jungle, I climb out into open fields with far-reaching views. The contrast is startling, and I need a few minutes to get used to the bright sunshine. There are views to Lyme Regis in front of me as I walk onwards, and the sight of the calm, endless sea warms my bones. At some point over the next mile or so, I pass the county border into Dorset. Devon, like Cornwall, is now a thing of the past. Dorset is the final county. Da-di-da-da, da-di-da-da-da. You know, as in The Final Countdown by 80s Rockers Europe. That one's going on the LP for sure. I continue across the fields, past a small stream, and down one last steep wooded descent before emerging at the harbour side of this popular tourist spot. The first thing anyone arriving in Lyme Regis will notice is the famous cob, the harbour construction dating back to medieval times. It's of huge historical importance, playing significant roles in the sinking of the Spanish Armada and in the defeat of the Royalists during the English Civil War. It's also got something to do with Jane Austen, apparently. I stroll along it, and then onto the beach, soaking up the atmosphere of the bustling seafront before heading inland to find the pub I'm staying in. All in all, it's not a bad start for Dorset. Lyme Regis is a pretty, if overpriced, place, with a few nice-looking pubs and places to eat. After checking in, I wander back down and decide on a pizza restaurant for dinner. Whilst quaffing down a quattro formaggi, I think back on the last 2 days of walking. What a spectacular and fitting way for Devon to sign off from the trail. Chapter 5. Dorset. The Wrong Pub, Portland Bill, and The Final County. Da-dee-da-da, da-dee-da-da-da. The following day begins with a long and arduous inland diversion between Lyme Regis and Charmouth. The whole of this section of path is closed due to erosion, and the diverted route follows a busy and unpleasant main road the entire way. The majority of the time there is no pavement, and there are many more than a few hairy moments. The situation isn't helped by the weather. A thick